Welcome to AZMcast, a peer-reviewed, evidence-based podcast heavily seasoned with expert opinion. For all you new listeners, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial on how to use this podcast to its fullest potential. For you faithful veterans, you can go ahead and skip ahead to the good stuff. As you listen to this podcast, you'll hear contributors give opinions on everything from practice styles to diagnostic evaluations to emergency medicine philosophy. When you hear the bell ding, that means that the opinion is backed by evidence. Check your screen on your device to see the reference paper, and we suggest taking a screenshot for future reading. When you hear the turkey gobble, that's just our opinion, and you can decide whether you want to take it or leave it. Everybody, and welcome to the March episode of AZMcast. Now, if you've listened to our podcast for the last 5 years, or 5 months, or 5 seconds, 6 seconds, seven, anyway, you've gained some medical knowledge, we hope, and you've crammed it into your brain, and now we want to help you to apply that knowledge to the best of your ability toward your shifts in the ED. This month, we're talking about ED flow, and specifically your role in it. So whether you're pushing the flow or you're the rate-limiting step, we've all been there at some point. What we hope is this discussion will help you to be more efficient so you can do the most good for the most people and not burn yourself out in the process. So it's time to lace up your running shoes and hold your bladders for this month's episode on ED flow. I do. I love Jared quite a bit. I love Jared a lot. So it's March.
Keep that in, by the way.
I love Jared a lot.
Yeah. That should be your intro statement.
I'm probably gonna start every episode from here on out with I love Jared a lot.
That's your name.
It's March, and March is a very special time of year, I feel, in the emergency department. It's kind of springtime is here. The birds are chirping. It's 80, sometimes 90 degrees out in Tucson. And there's a coming of age for our interns and juniors.
The teenager period, if you will.
It's very pubertal.
Yeah.
There's a lot of sweating. There's hair in funny places. Sometimes gray hair at this point.
Wild emotions
for sure. So you guys that are residents are about to promote in a couple months, but there's 3 months left. And you've got interns that are maybe starting to get your feet under you. You've done enough emergency blocks that you have a good feeling of what you need to do. You have juniors that have really kind of mastered the part of just seeing patients, multitasking, seeing them fairly quickly. And then you've got the seniors that are looking ahead and maybe have reverted back to intern status of, I don't know if I can do this again. I saw this graph that Al Sakady put up at a conference, and it was confidence levels throughout residency, and it was intern scared to death, and then a bell curve straight up of junior year, which is recklessly confident, and then right back down to senior year, which is the same as intern starting over again. I don't think that's necessarily the case, but for a lot of us it was.
Definitely, and it's appropriate, right? Your rubber's hitting the road when you're on your way out of residency, and you're starting to realize that some of these decisions you're going to be making without being able to bounce it off of somebody else.
So what we decided we wanted to talk about was how to manage flow in the ED. This is going to be a lot more of a practical discussion with Brian and Chris and I about how we run through the ED and how we actually manage patients. And then we're going to loop back around to have a philosophical discussion with Dr. Mosher. So he's going to be...
That's what I'm good for.
But then we're going to come back around to talk about ED flow as a whole, because especially for you seniors and those of you that are practicing right now, ED flow is a real thing. It's metrics that you are judged by. It's how people who don't actually do medicine, but maybe are in the C class of administrators are looking to see how well you're doing. So there is a little bit of playing the game, and there's a lot more of how well the patient's getting taken care of. So I like March because I think March is an appropriate time for interns to really try to start running the board. It's something that we talk about at Step Up Dinners when we do that in a few months, but to kind of preempt that, I think it's a great time to come onto your shift as an intern with your junior and your senior resident there with you and tell them, I would like to see as many patients as I possibly can today, to start stretching my wings, to start seeing how far I can push myself. And during these shifts, you can try to work really, really hard. And if you end up falling behind a little bit and you aren't able to pick up those next patients, it's okay to tap out and to tell the junior or senior, look, I'm behind. I don't think I can really do this. Can you help me out? Will you pick up patients? And I think this is a good time for the next 3 months to start practicing that.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. My one caveat would be that as you're picking up more patients, don't lose the flow that you currently have. I mean, I try to tell the interns when you started, to me, you need to see the patient, you need to write your orders, you need to write most of your note and complete everything that you need to do for that patient before adding on in the second patient. And if you get really good at that, then you'll be able to pick up patients faster, and those times will condense themselves. You'll learn what the critical questions are to ask. You'll learn how to do a history while you're doing some physical exam findings. You'll learn to order, put orders in at the bedside while that patient's telling you the story that just keeps going and going and going. And you want to show that you're interested in it, but at some point you have to move on. So how do you balance all this? Well, you've got to be able to do that. You then have to add a second patient, but you also have to loop back to the patients that you have. So when Aaron's saying adding more patients, you're just going to continue this process on a faster pace. So you're getting through a whole patient, adding a second one, getting through them, rechecking the first one. Okay, everything's done. Now add the third patient. Get through the whole third patient. Go check one and two. Can you do anything with those? Then add the fourth patient. Don't just start adding six patients. Don't do any notes. Don't put any orders in. Don't present anyone. And just have assigned yourself to a bunch of patients. Meanwhile, your other junior and senior are sitting there waiting to pick up a patient and have nothing to do.
That's the junior level trap, is eight patients are on the board. I just picked up eight patients and I don't have time to actually see them all. And then when I finally seen them all, they're waiting for all of my orders. And when all their orders are back, I have to dispo all of them. And then nobody's moving. But when they do move, it's in giant chunks of 8, 12 patients at a time. And then what happens? All eight beds get emptied. All eight beds get filled at once. And you end up with this stop-and-go shift, yeah, which is just grating on
you. We always complain about these boluses of patients, and it took me quite a while in residency. I was a senior before I figured out, oh, I'm causing this. This is my fault. Unless it's like right after 7 o'clock, then we know it's the nursing change fault, and that's just something that's inevitable. But
we love you nurses that still listen to us.
But it's an inevitability, right? You know, everyone kind of shuts down and leaves, and then people get triaged and roomed, and that happens around shift change. But the rest of those boluses that you're experiencing are actually caused by you. And I love what you said about just getting to the point, Brian, where everything happens a little quicker. You're doing the same things. You're finding a flow that worked for you when you were only picking up one or two at a time, and then just expanding that to maybe picking up three at a time, and just doing the same things quicker. And when I was a brand new intern, actually it was during our orientation, Sam Kime was our program director at the time. And I remember being in this boardroom, actually with you, Aaron, you were there too. And Sam said, inevitably, all of you will come and ask, how do I get faster? How do I get more efficient at this? And he says, I'll give you the straight answer, and it's going to sound really glib, but it's true. The really fast physicians are the ones that do everything quicker. And I thought, not really mind-blowing there, Sam. What do you mean by that? It took me a long time, and I started working with people like Amol Desai, who was very quick, and Mark Urban, who was very, very quick. And it was that they would sit down, and you already know what you need to do. You know what the next step is, but it's when you sit down and second-guess yourself and say, well, what about this? Or you interpret a lab, and you say, well, but what about this? And if you keep rehashing those critical decisions, those critical forks in your decision tree, and rethinking it, you're going to slow yourself down too much. If you know what the next step is, then do it. The second thing I learned from Mark Urban, and this was dispo comes first. Dispo comes first. So you sit down.
If that's actually stolen from the House of God, by the way.
It is. Yeah. So he was good at it. And he would sit down and he would say, if you have to put in orders, pick up another patient, and dispo a patient, you dispo the patient first, and then move on.
So I actually heard a different route to that. It's a little bit different because it just places the burden on the emergency part of it. And my flow that I heard, that I always tell people, is from Ash Panchal, who is a fantastic doctor. And he said, first, anytime you get a few seconds to sit down and actually look at your charts, look at your computer, look at whatever you have, first thing you do is check on your sick patients. And you should have no doubt in your mind who your sick patients are. And they need to be managed first for a couple of reasons. First of all, what we're supposed to be doing in the emergency department is dealing with emergencies. So if we're not doing that, then we've become what Jared always calls glorified triage. We're just kind of figuring out where people go in the hospital and not actually treating patients. The second reason is for a purely ED flow mindset. If you eliminate the patient care part of it, which you should never do, sicker patients end up being more work for you if you don't keep up on them. If you check on them once every 30 minutes for a minute or so, it's going to save you having a patient that decompensates on you, and that's a lot more time. And that sounds like a very, maybe a cruel or a dehumanized look at it. But if you're focused on flow, then get an idea of keeping up on your sick patients really will help you with your flow. And then the second thing after that is doing your dispos, discharge any patient who can be discharged, admit any patient who can be admitted, then check on your labs and imaging. If that allows you to dispose somebody or shows that somebody's got an emergency, take care of that. Then go see your next patient. This does not mean don't sign up for any patients during this time. It means go do these things before you go see your next patient. Because that patient that just got back into a room is getting registered and seeing the triage nurse or seeing their new nurse for the first time, getting blood drawn. They are getting some face time with a medical provider. It doesn't have to be you immediately. If while you're doing this other stuff, they can wait for 5 minutes and then you go see them versus having the person who's been in the ED for 5 hours already continue to wait for another half an hour to an hour while you go start a new patient.
I want to add a couple things. Three things.
We weren't going to bring you until the end.
Yeah, I got to chime in. Number one is we all want to get faster, right? And the people who are faster are the ones who do everything quicker. And that adds the human element of cutting corners. And so you let the patient talk until they hit a trigger word. And then you put them into a little bucket, right? Oh, ACS, oh, abdominal pain, oh, weak and dizzy, must be stroke, stroke workup, done, boom, move on, right? And then you totally miss the fact their blood sugar is 20 or something. And so you have to check in with yourself very frequently during your shift of, am I making one of these mistakes? Number two, you have to be careful not to want both sides of the coin, right? You can't talk about how these patients who don't need to be in the emergency department but then not want to take care of the sick patient, want the sick patient to get out of there because you have to take care of all these other patients that are in the emergency department. You can't have both sides of the coin.
Absolutely true.
Yeah, the third thing is, you know, the specialty is going in the direction that it's going in for better or for worse, right? And what that means is that there is this obsession with flow. What that means to you is you need to take it upon yourself to follow up on your patients because you will be wrong. And the only way you're going to know how to improve yourself the next time you're seeing a patient similar to that is to say, last time I saw this, I thought it was X and I was wrong. So you have to really make a conscious effort as you're getting faster to follow up with your patients the next day or the day after.
There are a few things as terrifying as going to check up on a patient and the box comes up and says, you are about to enter the chart of a deceased patient. Are you sure you want to do that? No, I was trying to open my patient's chart, who was fine. and then turns out that you had a bad outcome, yeah, or that the patient had exactly what you thought it was. Either way, you are training your haggis right now, right, to learn what works and what doesn't. And when you are wrong, you need to alter that a bit.
And the reality is, I was just having this conversation with one of the nephrology attendings yesterday. The reality is, the more experienced you are, the more you're wrong. Or at least the more often you know you're wrong, probably because you're more sensitive to it. But you have to follow up with your patients to see what happened.
Yeah. And so interns right now, especially as you're starting to really develop this, when you get into your junior year, when July hits, you will be shocked at what the new interns do not know. And you will be shocked at how some of the interns will see two patients for an entire shift. And that's not an exaggeration. And so when July hits, that's the wrong time to say, well, let me see what I can do. Now's a great time to try to stretch this. I think that another tip that I usually have in thinking about all of your patients as a whole is I organize my patients by time and room, or length of stay in the ED. That way, when I'm going through, there's no doubt in my mind who the sick patients are. And then I know who's been here the longest. Those are the people I need to dispo. And if I can do that, then I'm going to do it. And then the other patients that just got here, I don't mind signing up for a patient or two, run through my list real fast, and then go see them. How you organize your charts, how you organize your list can be very helpful to managing your flow.
It's painful now in the days of EMR. When we had all the clipboards, it was easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was much easier back then.
Well, plus it was only three of us on shift at any given time, so we had the whole doc box to ourselves for all 15 of our clipboards.
But find what works for you. Some people are good using EMRs and making their own lists, electronic lists. I still rely on a combination. Actually, when we switched to Cerner, I had to rely even more on paper than I ever had before. I don't know. Do you use paper much, Brian? Or you've got such a big brain, you just probably...
I don't anymore. I think when I started here, I did. Now, to me, the mechanism has slowed down where I know where all the rooms are. I know what rooms I have in my head. And so it's a balancing of, okay, I have these 40 patients or I have these 20 patients. And I say, okay, these are admitted patients. They've been here. I don't need to spend as much time on them. These are my active patients, and trying to balance what I need to do. And so for me, it becomes I do it all by time. So everything to me has a time metric, meaning that I know that if I see this person with DKA, I'm probably going to spend the first 10 minutes in the room. I then will need to be checking in on them in 15 minutes because that's when my venous gas and hopefully is back and I can get my insulin up and running. I also know maybe that belly pain that I saw who's 80, I'm ordering a CT scan of the abdomen pelvis. And I know that to me that it won't be back within 60 minutes. There's not much I can do in that 60 minutes other than alleviate their suffering with maybe a couple doses of opiate and checking on them if I think they're unstable. But for most of our belly pains, they're not unstable. And so I don't need to check on that person for 60 minutes. But in the 60 minutes, the labs will be back. Then I need to plug and make sure the medications were given and that the CT scan is happening. So for me, everything is a time basis and trying to figure out how long certain laboratory tests take for you. How long... Mm-hmm. You should be re-examining that patient, right? Maybe it's you just needed a single dose of pain medicine and repeat a belly exam. Maybe that's a 30-minute turnaround. How fast is your nurse? How fast are your point-of-care tests coming back? Oh, this is going to be a procedure. Maybe I should go. It's probably going to take me 15 minutes to do this laceration repair versus, oh, boy, this is a peritonsillar abscess. I'm probably going to have to step away for 30 to 45 minutes to work on this patient. I better get everything else done. So that's how I balance. And then knowing that, I also in my head have, at 4 hours, I probably should have disposed of these patients. Mm-hmm. I should know what's going on at 4 hours of working with them. That's a couple. That's laboratory tests back. That's, you know, maybe I've ordered imaging tests. I should have done serial exams. I should have done treatment. And I should have a good idea of where they're going to go. And most patients, for me, at the 2 hour mark, I have an idea, if not right away.
Even though I know the term is disposition, I have a hard time disposing of patients. That sounds more like more like a flow focus. Brian brings up a great point about knowing how long it takes for common labs to come back for a couple of reasons. One is that if the labs aren't back properly, then you should think maybe they're abnormal, meaning that the lab is rerunning them because you've got a critical value. The other thing is maybe your nurse, your medic, your tech is having a hard time getting an IV and getting blood. And if that's the case, what do we need to do next? Maybe you just need to get a butterfly needle to draw some labs and while you're waiting on stuff. Or if this is a patient that you really needed access on, you should know, man, I should have had my blood back by now. I wonder what the deal is. Come to find out, your nurses are still struggling with a line. Maybe you need to go help them. The other thing is it will help you to manage your patient's expectations. I always tell patients that we never forget about you, but it gets really busy on the other side of this door, on the other side of the curtain. And so if you haven't heard from us in a while, please don't feel bad about asking. We will check in as soon as we're able to, but your labs will take you about an hour and a half to maybe 2 hours, depending on what we're ordering. Your imaging should take you 2 to 3 hours, we hope, depending on what you're ordering. And this is going to be the plan. So we will certainly check back in with you when we know some more information. But if you need to hear from us sooner, please ask your nurse.
Yeah, I think giving your patients a time, you know, the ones that you think maybe it's just an x-ray at home, we'll hopefully have you out of here in 1 to 2 hours at most. You know, the chest pain, I can tell them usually, hey, you're here probably 2 to 3 hours, imaging 2 to 3 hours, maybe 3 to 4 hours. But giving them an expectation up front, I think, is reasonable. And you're also helping, you know, allay their fears, like, oh, someone forgot me. They haven't come to see me. And that allows you to see more patients, right? We are the rate-limiting step. The doctor should be the rate-limiting step in the ER. Everything else...
We should be.
We should be. And you have to, I think, practice as you are the rate-limiting step. Because otherwise...
Right.
Then... Right, everything else is messed up. And there are times we will change patients' sheets, and there are times that we need to do things. But, you know, with you being the rate-limiting step, what are those things? Like Aaron said, IV access. It's okay to ask a person if they're a hard stick. If they are, go get the ultrasound. Just put the thing in yourself. If you want to urine on this patient, like Aaron's talked about before, you walk them immediately to the bathroom and hand them a cup and ask for a teaspoon of urine. You just get it done. Don't waste your time. Those are the things that will slow down your flow, and you know, not to anger Jared, but flow really to me is trying to get the patient where they need to be in a timely manner and effective. And patients don't want to sit there waiting for 3 hours not knowing they had to pee, and that was all that there. And so that screws it up, and then you can't put your time onto that sick patient that you really need to. Now, oh, I got to find the urine on this person. Where is it? I don't know. Did they have a cup? Did the urine get lost in the lab? You know.
And that's what leads to your partners, your colleagues getting upset at you about, so I got this 80-year-old lady who came in with, you know, altered mental status, so just waiting on the urine. So if you could follow up on that and just go according to the urine, that would be great. That's a good way to get slapped.
Yeah.
So for juniors transitioning over to seniors, just know that the current interns, some of them will be ready to go come July. They'll be able to run the board no trouble, and some of them won't, and that's fine. For my EMPEDS interns, I love you, all four of you, we do not have these same expectations for you, okay? You are on a different learning curve from everyone else, and I promise it will come back around, and the interns in a couple years will look at you like amazing TV doctors. So for the juniors that are transitioning to seniors, you're going to have students with you. You're going to be trying to look at the ED as a whole. Now, this does not mean that you sit there and assign patients to everybody and then, you know, pontificate to your medical student all day.
Is that still true, or is that a fever dream?
About what?
Managing the whole ED. I mean, it's 60-something beds. There's 17 people working at any one time. Can one person really manage it? I think it's ridiculous.
I only think it's fair to say it's time to start considering it.
Right.
Not managing it, but yeah. Starting to pretend that you're managing it and starting thinking about... I'll be honest with you. I wasn't able to see the ED until maybe 2 or 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I've been attending here for 6, so...
It's like being able to hear Jimmy. White Man Can't Jump. I mean, you can listen to Jimmy, but you got to be able to hear Jimmy.
It absolutely is, nobody got that reference. But
I don't care.
Us four.
It's my job to revive culture that is seemingly lost in the 90s.
I think the thought is to go beyond just your patients.
Yeah, it's not parallel play anymore.
Right. It's how do I... Oh, are the other residents seeing patients? Are they having trouble? Maybe they're in a central line and they've disappeared for an hour or something. And understanding what do I need to do to help out, or how can I help other beds move? And I think it's a hard thing right at the beginning of your senior year to expect to know the entire department. I think that, especially with a 40-bed university, or even at South, at 20-some, that's a hard thing to do. Unless you start with a small department in the morning. You're coming on, I think that's reasonable when you go up to 15, 20 patients, that you should, well, we only got 10 patients right now, I can kind of know what's going on. But I think as you move towards the end of your senior year, starting to get a bigger picture, but the bigger your department, it's going to be harder to truly see all the
pieces. Yeah, I feel like as a third year, what you should be able to do is understand and appreciate what kind of workload the other people on shift with you are dealing with, what the bed situation looks like, and what the barriers to the improving that bed situation are. To me, that's, if you can do that, you don't need to know the micromanaging of every other person in the department or what patients they have, but you should have a sense of what are the barriers to making things better.
So I think that the one caveat to that is if you're the recess captain, you're on one of our shifts here at university, or like they do at South, where your only job is to help resuscitate, that's your opportunity to prepare for what you're going to do when you're done, which is to oversee the care in the department where you're at. If you're in a single coverage ED, you need to be able to see the forest through the trees. You need to be able to understand, why aren't patients going upstairs? What does my lobby look like? Who are the sick patients? How can I help out? What are my partners doing, and do they need help with something? So that it becomes more of a team sport. Our fourth and fifth year EMPs residents do a pretending block with us where they take over, and it's every single one of them has always been a little bit shocked at what it takes to actually keep stuff flowing, because there are beds, there are issues like, oh, the wrong order was put in, so they're not going upstairs. There are issues like, we've got a dog bite to the face that Plastics wants to repair. Just kidding, they would never do that. That somebody wants to repair, but that's going to be a sedation that's going to last about 30 to 45 minutes, and given the acuity of the department right now, I just can't do that. So we need to come up with another plan. I can't, send myself away. One time when I was a brand new attending, I went and did a 1 hour long sedation and MRI for a kid and left the department for an hour. That was a mistake. And I will never do that again, because we can't do that. So it's that kind of managing the department versus, as Jared said, micromanaging each individual person and making sure that they're going. My job when I come on to shift is to make sure nobody dies. And I trust a lot of you to take good care of the patients while I'm trying to manage everybody that's coming through.
I think doing a pretending shift, I have a lot of the South Campus residents will do pretending shifts with me, and I think it's a good experience in your senior year to go and, get that perspective of what, just being in the hip pocket where I'm just whispering, go do this, go do that, go do that. And so they kind of appreciate what it's going to take on that next level. It's not that they're going to be able to do it right away, but it's seeing it, right? And it's seeing it through different eyes, and I'm managing three residents as an attending, as opposed to you as a resident managing your colleagues. So it's different levels, and just getting glimpses into that during your senior year, I think, is a good idea. So juniors, have that in the back of your mind as you're heading into your senior year. When is a good time to do that? Is it on a selective? Is it maybe during a recess shift? Maybe I can somehow flow that into a recess/pretending shift. I think it's a really good experience.
One last comment that I want to make to the juniors is I want to talk to the trauma psych junior. Every year, there's one resident at least who knows that if all I pick up is trauma patients and psych patients, that the consultants will do all my dispo for me. And I won't really have to do all that much. I'll pick them up. I'll sit down, write my note, go pick up another one. They're the first ones to page out for the combative alcoholic patient who's suicidal, first ones to go to the trauma white or red, and I know somebody else will do my work for me. We know who you are. You have been labeled. Stop it. Stop doing that.
I didn't know that was a thing.
You guys know, don't you?
Oh, I know.
Oh, wow.
We won't name names, but we all can think of, over the years, the trauma psych resident. Don't be the trauma psych
resident.
Some
people are really good at it.
It will hurt you. If you are the person that only picks up patients that are easy, you will not be prepared to go and get a real job.
Good. Well, and also with that, just because you're a senior now doesn't mean you should have less patience and wind down earlier. I think that's, to me, a misconception. I think the senior should have most patients because their flow is better. They're able to handle more. They can ask the questions quicker. They're able to balance more things. So to me, they should have more patience than the junior, then should have more patience than the intern. That's, to me, a natural flow. You have a medical student. Yes, you can see that as a hindrance. I would see it as a help, that they could go see someone else and pad your numbers, because you guys are always worried about your numbers and how many patients I saw on a shift. But I think that's a realistic expectation. Don't say the junior should have more patients than the senior. To me, that is a fallacy that I've been told here, and I think is just wrong.
And there's seniors there that do that, and we know who you are as well. But if we can remove the mask, as it were, we've been for years and years, like Brian alluded to, telling the juniors, you're now going to run the department. You're the workhorse for the department. I like that we say that because it gets them in that mindset. But then, inevitably, partway through senior year, I'll start hearing from the seniors, you know, I was told that the juniors were the workhorse of the department, but I'm seeing more people than I did last year, or as many as the juniors are every shift. And I'll say, that's the dirty little secret, which is you as a senior are not seeing fewer patients than your junior. You are seeing at least as much as your junior, probably more. What you'll find is that you're ending your shifts without being as disheveled and upset about it, and maybe feeling as inefficient as you did as a junior. Also, you're taking on more responsibilities, maybe in a leadership and teaching role.
Mm-hmm. And I'll give a couple shout outs, not to exclude people, but just a few people off the top of my head who really just ran it out third year and didn't limp across the finish line, but really sprinted across. People like Chris Williams said, not Chris, but like he said, people like Amalda Sy, people like Mark Urban, people like Rad Ratnabal Siriar, Sean Wentworth. There are some of these residents that, just put their head down and keep working. And that's what's going to prepare you to be the best that you possibly can as you go out. So in preparation, these residents are ready for attending life. They really are. But it's an entirely different workflow. Here is the single most difficult thing I had in transitioning from being a resident to an attending, and that is I no longer presented my patients, which meant that time that I usually took to gather my thoughts and say, all right, 48-year-old with female with chest pain, shortness of breath, who's, you know, got a previous plane flight. Oh, crap, this is a PE. All right, well, maybe I should think of PE. When that's no longer a part of your routine, you can just get into a standardized mode, like Jared said, and put everybody in a box and pass over stuff. So I started quickly presenting to myself and just going through the motions. Now as an attending, when I have a resident present to me, it's the same time of actually taking a couple seconds to think about the patient and say, oh, wait a minute, no, this sounds like this could be something strange.
Yeah, the other thing that I catch myself doing is, if I'm at the end of a shift, I have to ask myself, what would I do with this patient at the beginning of my shift?
Yeah, that's a great idea.
If it's one of those days where you're admitting a lot of patients and you start trying to find ways to send them home, and you think, if this was at the beginning of my shift, I would definitely admit this person, then you just know you're going to make a bad decision.
Yep.
Or how am I going to sign this person out? You know, I just need to hurry up and make a dispo. You know, sometimes
order the MRI.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
We had an attending, too.
Tuesday, attending Wednesday yesterday, which Nat Johnson and I worked, and we just laughed the whole time about our memory of attending Tuesday and the signouts you would get. So this is a patient you're going to have to do de novo. They only came in about 45 minutes ago, so I haven't really had a chance to see him, but I put in some orders. There's a D-dimer in there somewhere, so if you could just take that patient, that'd be great.
And then admit him.
Yeah.
It was always the attendings with the highest slugging percentage that were working those attending teams.
Slugging percentage.
Slugging percentage. Oh, that's awesome. So, you know, seniors, you've got to work on your on this flow because basically you are about to enter a realm where you are judged. I like to think that residency is your last time in the academic womb before you have to go out and face the harsh realities of the real world of where you are judged constantly on your metrics. You're judged on your patients per hour. You're judged on your length of stay. You're judged on your time to antibiotic time, your time to first contact in the ED. If you go to work for one of those really nice practices with a billboard out front that says current wait time, 0 minutes, you better keep that time low or else you're going to be hearing from people up in the C-suite. So these are things that you can practice now. You can ask people about, maybe not me, but maybe Chris, Brian, who have worked out in, you know, a real job at some point. But talk to people about how to get these things nailed down, get them polished. And this is your time to ask attendings about the stuff that scares you.
I would say that I agree with 80% of what you said, 90% of what you said, but I would argue, and this is an olive branch to Jared, find the metrics that you care about and then only care about those metrics. Don't care about a metric just because someone else is hanging a dollar sign over your head or because someone is arguing that it's important to them. Hear their point of view. Try and understand their point of view. I have been swayed multiple times in both directions with metrics, but I'll give you an example. One metric that I never cared much about was press Gainey scores. And so when I went to my first job out of residency, that was important to them, and they would have a meeting every month where they would go through press Gainey scores. I never went to it. And they posted the scores in a book. I never looked at it. I can to this day say I never once saw a press Gainey score because I didn't care about it. And so certain things I do care about, like door-to-provider time, I care about that. Door-to-dispo time, I think that's important as well. And there's a bunch of metrics that are important, but not all metrics are important.
So I think that leads us naturally into kind of the backward scheme of we told you how our opinions on how to be efficient and how to manage your ED flow. Now we're going to go all the way to the beginning and discuss, is ED flow even important? And Jared, you've been so nice and polite and patient. We're just going to let you go for it.
Well, I mean, yeah, of course it's important. But
all right, we're going to end it right there.
What I don't like is this obsession with flow at the expense of patient care. And even the definition of emergency medicine has changed over the years, where it went from, you know, we're the specialists in, you know, the acutely ill and injured patient to, you know, we're the safety net for people trying to access the healthcare system. And that's fine. I'm not saying one is more valuable than the other, but what I don't like is how our resuscitation is for the department, and the only vital sign we care about is the number of people in the waiting room left without being seen. I mean, you look at your performance metrics, patients per hour, length of stay, time to first contact.
These are mine. I didn't make these.
Well, but those are the metrics that we're judged on, right? And that's because hospitals, the bulk of business for a hospital comes to the emergency department. So they want the customers who are accessing that hospital to be very happy and well coddled. And we have just agreed to do that, either directly or indirectly, over time. And so what we have said is, you know, now we will take care of everyone, and we won't discriminate based on your level of acuity. We all went into this specialty because we wanted to take care of sick patients. But now those sick patients have become a hindrance to ED flow. And the sicker the patient is, the faster we either want some other service involved, or we want the patient out of the emergency department. And all your metrics there don't have a damn thing to do with patient outcomes, right? It's not how often you were wrong, how often you were right, what your mortality was compared to your coworkers. None of that that has anything to do with patient care. And so that's kind of my beef with this obsession with patient flow, and I'll stop there.
Well, I think what we first have to do is ask ourselves our why, our purpose, and we have to decide, are we providing a consumer-based service, or are we providing a humanitarian-based service? Do we go into this to be driven by economics or to be driven by a duty? I think that I saw a model. Actually, Aaron, you listed an article on the effect of split flow, and it mentioned a vertical split flow. And one of the things it mentioned was to get consultants involved in the disposition process earlier. And I thought, wow, that's a really quick way to slow down my flow if I have to get consultants involved. Then I remembered my time in New Zealand. I was only there for a month, but I was in a very, very busy hospital called Middlemore. And you can kind of think of Middlemore as like their county hospital. It's right near Auckland, but it takes care of a lot of the underserved populations, Pacific Island populations there in New Zealand. And the way their flow works, which is very efficient, an emergency physician picks up a patient, basically goes in and does an extended triage. You're getting an H&P, spending about as much time as we do with our patients, but if they know they can quickly dispo them, then they'll dispo them. But if it's anything involving an organ system that has another specialty associated with it, they contact that physician's service and they do what they call flick the patient. And that patient, now once you consulted that service, that patient now assigned to that service, and it is that service's responsibility to get the patient out of the department. Now, in that healthcare system, it actually worked great. It worked fine, and that would not work fine here. They have grown up in a system that has a very, very good, robust primary care service that they can depend on patients getting quick follow-up. And furthermore, their consultants view emergency department patients as emergency department patients, and they come down immediately, and they dispo fast. So it wasn't a problem from flow. It works great for them. But let me tell you how their emergency physicians practice. If a patient needs to have any orthopedic procedure like a reduction, an orthopedist does it. If they need to be intubated, ICU does it. If you have a question about an X-ray, the orthopedist evaluates and dispositions that patient. And you are just a triage doctor. I've never had a problem with being called a triage doctor because I think that's our primary purpose, but that's not our only purpose, and I wouldn't do it if it was my only purpose. And that's the fear we run into if we continue to take on this concept that our job as emergency physicians is only to improve flow. Other people are going to fill in those gaps for resuscitation, and I think that's what invigorates us as a
patient. But doesn't it feel like in the 10 years that we've been doing this that we're inching closer and closer to that, though?
Yeah, it does.
I'm not saying that both aren't important, right? I mean, the problem is that people that are now doing critical care and emergency medicine are publishing things that are saying, the longer you stay in the emergency department, your risk of mortality goes up and whatnot. And the response can't be, how do we get them out faster? It should be, how do we do a better job? And I think the waiting room is important, but the reaction of, we have to get our left without being seen down to zero because someone in the waiting room might be sick. Well, the farther you push that, just based on the principle of the bell curve of acuity, the farther you push that, the more the probability that you're going to find someone who would have been sick gets smaller and smaller, right? So So the only way that we can meet both goals, right? We say, we take care of sick patients, but we're not. We want all these consulting services to come down and swoop them out of the ED faster. Well, we have to do that because we're the safety net for these other people. They don't have primary care. But when's the last time you started a prescription for an antihypertensive,
right?
Or antihyperglycemic?
It's a fallacy.
So we're trying to do all of these things, and we're telling ourselves we're awesome at them, but we're not doing a very good job at any of them. So I think the only thing that we can do as a specialty is to say all of these things are important, and the solutions that we think should happen are not, they're not realistic, right? We're not going to build 50 more ICU beds per floor and hire an army of hospitalists and a ton of primary care doctors. So we need to change the model in which we deliver emergency care. I think that's what that our specialty needs to do.
So I don't mind when there's a bunch of patients that are waiting out in the lobby that are ankle sprains and I need my rabies vaccine and some of the stuff that truly can wait, you know? What I don't like is when I've got 7 patients who are intubated on vents, on pressors, who are boarding in the ED, and I've got GI bleeds, I've got first trimester vaginal bleeds, I've got 80-year-old chest pain patients, I've got patients who are immunosuppressed waiting in the lobby. And I can't bring them back because even just that one-liner is enough to make you say, not maybe they're sick, they sound sick. I mean, they sound like somebody who needs more urgent attention than I can give them.
But don't you think I want those patients out of the ED too?
I'm
the ICU attending, I don't want my patients in the ED. I want them to be where I am.
Sure. And so the question is, at what point do you overload the capacity of not just the emergency department, but the emergency doctor's ability to do critical care on these patients? The more specialized we get, the more difficult it is to be good at it. One of my program directors from PEDS said that he remembers the day that he started looking down on other pediatricians because they no longer admitted their own patients from clinic. And he remembers his residency director saying he looked down on pediatric residents because they no longer made house calls. Now we're at a crossroads of where we're looking at actually severing some of our training programs into ambulatory and inpatient care, yeah, because the more specialized we get, we can't expect you to do it all.
I don't think that we're anywhere close severing outstripping what the capacity of emergency medicine training can do, right? It's the basic thing. It's managing a ventilator. It's reading a blood gas. It's managing hemodynamics. It's those kinds of things.
I will direct you to your emergency critical care bedside cardiac algorithm with 9 layers and about 5 different colors.
Well, I can tell you, we've been doing this shock team for this year, and Cameron and I were talking about it, and the number of patients that truly required our expertise were very small. Most of the time, it was just, you need somebody to manage the ventilator or manage some hemodynamics because you don't have time to do it, and so you say, well, their blood pressure's still low, let's just give them a couple more liters, right? It's those things. That is not even close to outstripping the capacity of what an emergency medicine trained physician can do. I think that putting someone on the 3-to-12 shift and saying your job is to manage the emergency department, and that includes all the people in the lobby and all the people that are going upstairs, and some days that's going to be a bunch of ICU patients and GI bleeds in the lobby, and some days it's going to be a bunch of people that don't need to be here. I think that is outstripping what we should ask of emergency medicine in the way in which we deliver it.
So I'm a flow guy, and my philosophy, you know, I don't really worry about metrics. I don't worry about legal stuff. My job is just to be the best doctor I can on that shift. And so to me, all of these flow from that. And in terms of if me being the best doctor is going to be taking care of this patient in the most efficient way I can and getting them to where they need to go and meeting their needs, my length of stay will be shorter. I will see more patients because I know I want to go see them as soon as they hit the door. I don't want to wait and, you know, go have a coffee or something. As soon as I see a new patient, yeah, I'll go see you. And how can we treat you and take care of you the best? And I spend my time with them. And part of it is I try to make the simple things simple so I can have time to spend on the difficult patients. And I try not to overthink an easy case. If you come in with an ankle issue, let's take care of the ankle issue. There's not much more. Now I have a sicker patient, I can spend time on it. And so I try to create my own cloud. People say they're a white collar or a black cloud. I think the sooner I can get patients either upstairs or admitted or discharged, the sooner I can take care of them, the less patients I have, the better better my flow, the sooner my ER waiting room is emptied, and the happier the patients are. Because most of our patients, whether they're sick or not sick, you know, they have lives. They want to know what's going on. What do I really have, doctor? You know, I got to pick up my kids later today. You know, can we get this done sooner? They want a decision on what, you know, they came in for. They came in with this complaint. What do you think, doctor? And we do our dance, and we have to give them a decision on what we think. The sooner we can get to that decision, the sooner they can be, you know, rest assured, they can feel better, they can go on with their care, whether it's outpatient or inpatient, and the sooner they get on with their lives. And so to me, you know, my patients per hour are pretty high. Do I bill a lot for those patients? No. But I don't try not to overthink them. You know, and part of it, you know, when I was out by myself, you know, we talk about, you know, doing repeat exams and, you know, missing things. And I definitely miss things. But part of my efficiency was I would see the patient, I'd come back, I'd re-see him. I would sign my chart and chart before I discharged that patient. And there were many times where I would, you know, read the EKG, it appears bradycardia, you know, flattened T waves or peak T waves, and then you start to like, huh, that's kind of interesting. They're potassium 7, and you're just like, what? And you just, you miss it the first three times, but now I've done my time where I've sat down, I've thought through this patient, I've gone through what else it could be, I finished their chart, and then I was gonna go discharge them or admit them. And so I get that closure moment. But that helped me in recapping. So doing charts later, I think, is a foolish thing. And I think mm-hmm. everyone should chart on shift. That's a whole other opinion. But the goal is try and take care of the patient the best you can. And doing that in an efficient, fast manner, I think, is good because it hits everything. You won't have to worry about your metrics. You won't have to worry about medical legally if you sat down and you've cared for them for 15 minutes. You won't have to. You've gotten your easy patients out. Now I can sit on my sick patients and really spend time and spend time and spend time. And then there comes a point where it's like, there's not much more I can do. I'm trying to turn it over to someone. And that's where I feel we should be able to turn it over. You should be able to package a sick patient to me in 1 hour. That's a 1 hour. I can have someone tubed, lined, pressors, fluid assessment, all that, ready to go to the OR, the unit in 1 hour. And if it's taking you longer than that, you need to work on it and get back to that point.
But Brian, I think everybody fantasizes about being like that.
Brian?
Yeah. No, where everything's patient-focused and you get all these things. But I mean, how many times do you hear people say, oh, well, let's just let the Mickey put the lines in? I would have died if I was a resident and said that, wouldn't you?
Yeah,
absolutely. And I think it happens without people realizing it, where you go from your mindset, that's the very idealistic mindset that we should all have, slipping into the patient is the bed, and you're waiting for the urine to free up the bed from the growth that's on top of it, you know, and the department is your patient. And I think people might wake up in the morning thinking they're doing things best for the patient, and they don't realize they're really taking care of the department.
Well, and so I think when we look at like sick patients, you know, some of the things. So to me, a central line isn't always an emergency room procedure. Mm-hmm. There are times I think you need to do it, but to me, we know we can start pressors and peripheral IVs. We know we can resuscitate peripheral IVs. So there, and if you have it higher up and bigger gauge, it's going to flow better. So the more proximal your IVs, I can put two ultrasound-guided IVs in the antecubital, and I can resuscitate someone just as fast as I could putting in a central line. And even if you're fast as a central line, right, that's a 15-minute procedure because now we do it super sterile. We can't just, you know, grab the kit and stick something in the groin. And you could get a 5-minute line in, but now, oh, they're going to pull that, so it becomes this whole, like, oh, I don't do that. So what I'm saying is there's certain things I don't think we have to do all the time. If you think that central line is needed for all these multiple medications and you couldn't get access, then by all means you should do it. There are certain things, though. If I've started pressors on a septic patient, resuscitated them, volume assessed them, I've got antibiotics going. Do I need to spend my time now doing a central line when I've stabilized them, or putting in an art line when my blood pressure is correlating, the patient's more alert? I don't think I need to.
It depends if you're the attending out in a community practice and you already know how to do a central line, or you're a junior in an emergency residency and this is an and they're going to need a line eventually, and this is your opportunity to learn.
Totally different. I think as a resident, you probably, if you don't feel comfortable, and you probably need to get your numbers, and you need to get that procedure down. When you go beyond and you're an attending, you know, how many times did I put a chest tube in as an attending? Rarely. I usually would call IR. Why? It was a nicer chest tube than what I did, and the patient would be sedated. I mean, it was a better experience overall. Now, this is not the life-threatening, but most of our chest tubes are not life-threatening chest tubes. So some of the procedures, which do hinder when you become an attending, procedures are a hindrance to flow, and we have to admit that in the grand scheme. It's not that you don't do the procedure. You just, is there a better way or someone else that may be more capable or have more time today to do that procedure than me?
I had a dog bite to the face come in several in the last week or two. It's dog bite season. Mm-hmm. And bit right through the medial canthus. And I am doing the sedation for an ophtho exam, which immediately I see dog bite to the face, and that is my thought. After I go, man, this is awful what happened to this kid. This is going to be a sedation, and you need to make that decision very quickly so you can discuss with your nurses, you can start to get stuff ready, because this is going to be a sedation. Everybody needs to plan for it. And they looked in, and the ophtho resident asked me, so would you be able to sedate this kid for about an hour while we do the repair at bedside? And I said, no, I can't. Yeah. I don't have an hour to do this. That is not because I don't care about this patient, but that's because that's not safe. And giving this kid an hour's worth of ketamine means that they're going to recover in the ED for probably 4 more hours. So they're better off getting some SIVO or something like that in the OR and getting an actual focused repair by an ophthalmologist in a sterile environment rather than a makeshift ED sedation. So I think that there is something to be said about, you know, doing the procedure so you get the experience. But I agree with Brian. Procedures become a hindrance to a degree, and you have to learn how to work them into the rest of your care that you're giving everybody else.
So that's an example where your flow improved because of that decision, but I would argue your patient care also improved because mm-hmm. of that decision. And the simple way to know if you're doing it right is just insert family member there. I know some people disagree with that because they makes it too emotional. But you know what I mean. Is that something that you would have done for your kid in the ED, or would you have let him go to the OR? And I think you did the right thing for your patient. Yeah. As far as prioritizing the department as a whole into your flow and the priority that you put moving people through the waiting room to the caring for the patients that you have right in front of you is, and this is something I've told Jared before, is I basically consider the department as one of my patients. It's not my only patient, so I've got a lot of patients, and it has a role. It does play a priority, but it's not the priority. It's just one of my many patients.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I'm clearly biased because of what I do, but I think both are important. I just think we are asking the emergency physician, the way in which we staff emergency departments in 2018, to do so much that we're not able to do most of it well. And we need to change it as a specialty. Do you know, has there ever been anything that shows door-to-doctor time improves outcomes?
I don't know.
Does even, I don't know. I mean, this is not a trap question. I legitimately
like door to first contact?
Door to provider.
Yeah, door to provider time? I do not know.
Or is it a marketing ploy? Like, come to our hospital.
It's a patient satisfaction marker.
I do know that there is an article that shows that when you've got emergency department crowding and an increased ED length of stay, that there is an effect on patient-oriented clinical outcomes, including actual
safety issues, higher rates of there's decreased time to antibiotics for sepsis and for pneumonia. So in those cases,
decreased time with cath lab. I think Jesse Pines does a lot of that research. But you know, the other thing I would say is if your patients per hour is like 4, you need more doctors. And if you're a group that's purposely doing that so that you can have a higher salary, just know that salary is coming at a cost.
Yeah, and it's likely going to all disappear when you make a mistake because you're focused on flow. I think
not in Texas.
You know, we jokingly said earlier the junior trap is picking up all these patients and then not being able to dispo them. I think the junior trap and the residency trap is starting to see every patient as a chart and starting to see every patient as a bed, because you don't want one more chart to do when you've already got a backlog of charts. And it's very difficult sometimes to take a step back and see the whole person that you're trying to treat. So when you're trying to manage your flow and your sick patients, I think we have to take the sick patients first. We have to consider everybody that's there. I always tell patients the first thing when I walk in, I'm very sorry you're here, because no one ever wants to come to the ER. Everyone is upset about having to be in the ER, except for that one guy who we can't get to leave for like 2 weeks, and he comes in 3 times a day. But most everybody is upset about coming to the ER. And so I think we have to see that these are people that are worried, they're scared, they're hurt, they're angry, they're frustrated, and try to deal with that. But it can be very hard, especially when you do your very best to help people and they malign you and they scream at you and they complain about the fact that they never got a blanket. It's like, really? But this is most of what we do, which is taking care of people that generally just want our help. And if you see that, I think that helps to align your care with all the other things that will essentially come in naturally.
From a human factors standpoint, it's the emergency medicine self-preservation version of the inpatient services turfing, right? You know, it's like, oh, well, their white count's 10.5. It's not a CCU patient, right? Emergency medicine can't do that. So it's, you know, sinking into yourself and just making them another chart or another bed that you have to get out of your way and off your list.
You want to be able to relate to these patients. And it's hard because we're all going to go through phases where we're burned out and it does appear like another chart, or there's those days where you're just like, why are you here? And it's hard. How do you hold yourself back and not convey that to the patient and take the time and think it through? Why are they here? What is the question that they're asking me to solve? How can I help them? And to take, you know, even if it's 5 minutes to figure that out, you take the 5 minutes, you figure it out, and you move forward. And you know you're going to, you know, you may know that this person's going to go home right away, but that's okay. Like, just answer their question. Don't see them as another chart. Take care of them and move on. And there may be someone who's not telling you what's going on and it has something really sick. And then, you know, you need to call Jared and ask for some help on these patients. But, you know, that's your job. That's what we're here for.
The way I try to restore a little humanity into it is, and I say this every year when we have this graduation talk, is ask people what they do. You know, there are some amazing people that you will take care of that you will never know it unless you ask.
I ask tattoo stories.
Dude,
I love tattoo stories. Yeah.
Yeah, some relation, I think. You know, what you do, what were you doing, or you see a shirt, and you're like, oh, you're a fan of them, and to relate to them in some way. Yeah. And you're able to, you know, people want to tell about themselves.
It allows me to still watch cartoons as a, you know, 35-year-old man. I think when it comes down to it, what I've kind of boiled our job in the ER down to is we have to recognize problems, we have to resuscitate people, then we have to risk stratify people, communicate to them what we're doing, communicate to our nurses, communicate to our consultants, our, you know, kind of final providers, and then dispo them, and then document what we did. Recognize, resuscitate, risk stratify, communicate, dispo, document. I think that's what we do over and over and over and over. And if you are not done resuscitating somebody, you can't start to risk stratify them. You can't start to dispo them. You're not done with resuscitate. You have to keep doing that. Our PEDS ICU does not take over care until a patient comes up to their unit, and we make that very clear, try to make it very clear to the residents that this patient is yours while they're in the ED. It's so easy to forget about a sign-out patient who's boarding, but those are the patients that will decompensate on you. So I think that as long as they are in your backyard, they are still your responsibility, even though you share it. So don't pass the buck on, you know, this patient has a question, this patient has a need or a concern. Just call the inpatient team. It's the inpatient team's problem.
But do you have any parting thoughts?
My parting thought would be, as an individual and as a specialty, we need to be intensely introspective. You know, on your shift, am I doing the right thing for this patient, or am I doing the right thing for myself? Am I cutting a corner? Am I making assumptions I shouldn't make? I think both individually on a daily basis and as a specialty on a more global basis, we need to be intensely introspective.
Yeah, I mean, I have become much more reflective over the last few years, you know, reflecting on how am I doing today on shift? Is today a day I'm on, or is today a day I'm off? And knowing your limitations, what are your skill sets? What are you good at? What are you bad at? You know, how am I treating people today? Have I just blown through a lot of people today, or have I actually sat down and held an old lady's hand? You know, what am I really doing today?
Yeah, what good did you do today?
Right, what good did I do? How did I make the world a better place today by coming to work here? And so I think, you know, I'm trying to reflect on that more, because I will get caught in, like, sometimes it is another chart. It is another thing. Oh, I've got, you know, you keep getting called out of the room. I mean, we all deal with interruptions. And so it's hard being introspective when these interruptions are just overwhelming. You just want to say, stop, let me take a break. And sometimes you need to do that. But, you know, keeping your flow going, trying to be ahead of things, don't let things fall behind. Be proactive, do the right thing for the patient, and you will be fine. Your flow will improve.
I think some of the best days I have are days where I took a patient that could have easily just been an admit, 90-year-old lady with chest pain. Well, let's just admit her. And then you actually spent the time, talked to her about it, and said, yeah, it only hurts when I raise my arm up. I've been doing these exercises recently with weights, and it hurts right over here in my pec. Do you think that's what it could be? Yeah, I totally do. And you actually take care of the patient based on their needs rather than taking care of your own
90 chest pain admit.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, 90% chance of admission, right? Age equals percentage of admission. So I think that you can enjoy your job better if you focus on taking the best care of the patient. And I think that means all the patients. I think we all agree that all of the patients are worth taking care of, even the ones in the lobby, even the ones in Army, even the ones in the hallway beds. They're all worth taking care of. And then you have to prioritize from that.
You guys are awesome.
I love Jared Mosier.
What's up, everyone? My name is Amol Desai, and I'm working currently in Austin, Texas. I work in a community hospital where we see 55,000 patients per year. We work 8.5-hour shifts and pick up patients for 7, so we tend to not sign out too much to the oncoming physician. During those 7 hours, on a slow day, we will see about 17 patients, and on a horrible day, we see anywhere between 25 to 30. We do have a significant amount of mid-level coverage, and 2 doctors are on for the most part, and mid-levels tend to take all the lower acuity patients, thus leaving us with the higher acuity patients. I appreciate the shout-outs that both Aaron and Chris gave me, but there were a lot of residents that used to see a significant amount of patients when we were all there. The big thing that I was told when I first started as an intern was, quote, be comfortable, be uncomfortable, end of quote. I specifically remember shifts at the beginning of my 2nd year when the new intern had just started, and Freddie Angermeyer and myself worked back-to-back days where the intern saw 4 patients each shift and he and I saw 22 each. It was at that point where I started asking my attending for advice as to how I could possibly manage to get better, because I felt like I was drowning. I had no idea what was going on with any of my patients, and I felt like I sucked at my job. I think this feeling is pretty common and something that we all go through. Occasionally, we've had med students rotating through our emergency room here in Austin, and I try to give them a bit of advice about time management. We always talk about the ABCs of resuscitation, but I like to quote the movie Boiler Room when Ben Affleck mentions that his ABCs are always be closing. For me, in the emergency department, my ABCDs are always be charting or dispositioning. I always think about what can I do to make my chart closer to being done, and what more information do I need to make a decision on whether someone can go home or be admitted. Jared's comment about working patients up different at the end of the shift versus the beginning is definitely valid. If you are ever feeling tired or lazy at the end of your shift and decide this patient seems okay without a scan, but you know that if it was the first patient of the day, you would scan them, do the right thing and don't cut corners. Every one of us makes mistakes. In the last month at my own hospital, we had a missed ankle dislocation on a trimalleolar fracture that somehow was sent home without a proper reduction, and just last week, someone missed a patient with a creatinine increase from 1.6 to 4.5 that got sent home, then returned the next day with a potassium of 7.5 and a creatinine of 5.5 that ended up coding. There's no way that these doctors did this because they didn't care, but with the stresses of meeting metrics and to see the next patient, things are missed. That is why you have to be systematic in the way you approach each patient. Take the few extra seconds and review the labs and imaging before sending patients home, especially in the patients that you're discharging. The idea of throughput and metrics is something that is unfortunately never going to go away. I go to 2 meetings per month where we discuss doctor to greet times, length of stay for level 4 and 5 patients, LPMSC, antibiotics given within an hour for sepsis, and total length of stay for patients prior to them being dispositioned. Your health these metrics, and I agree with Chris when he said focus on the ones that are important to you. The administration makes bonuses on these metrics, but you are the one at the end of the day responsible for the patient and their outcome. It's weird that no patient outcome metrics are talked about at our monthly meeting, but that is the sole reason we went into the specialty. My last bit of advice is to approach each day as an opportunity to get better at your job. I try to follow up on my patients that get admitted to see what I could have done differently and to learn from my mistakes. Each day is essentially like a new chess match for me. It's all about how I'm going to manage the acutely ill, the belligerent drunk, and the suicidal. As Brian said, make your priority the sickest and everything else will fall into place. My last bit of advice is make sure you really challenge yourself in residency, so that way when you are in the quote-unquote real world, you are not the doctor that people dread to work with because you can't carry your workload. A few of my coworkers came from a cush residency and they are now blown away by the pace of private practice. Push yourself now when you have an attending to fall back on, and you will be successful when you are on your own. Thanks again for having me, and good luck to everyone the rest of the year.